Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Kristen Turner, and my interview will be an unusual one for this podcast, as I have two guests today. They are Dr. Guthrie Ramsey, Edmund J. and Louise W. Kahn Term Professor of Music at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Carlene Brown, Professor of Music at Seattle Pacific University. They are with me to talk about The Heart of a Woman, The Life and Music of Florence B. Price. Tragically, the author of this much-anticipated biography, Dr. Ray Linda Brown, died in 2017. Guthrie stepped in to complete the final edits on the manuscript and wrote the foreword to the book, while Carlene wrote an afterword about her sister Ray Linda's professional work and lifelong promotion of Florence Price's music. In fact, it is doubtful that Florence Price's compositions would be experiencing the resurgence in popularity it is enjoying today, were it not for the tireless work of Ray Linda Brown. This biography places Price's life and music within the context of genteel, middle-class African-American culture and the active Black classical music scene in Chicago in the 1930s and 40s. Brown also analyzes Price's major pieces, teasing out the ways Price embedded influences from Black musical traditions into her concert music. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Before we sit down to talk about the book, I'd really like to start with talking about Ray Linda Brown, the author of this excellent monograph. I never got to meet her, but I've heard so much about her from people who were colleagues of hers in the Society for American Music. We just had a conference a few weeks ago, and our current president was talking about her then. And she's just always held up as a model of just a great scholar and obviously a beloved person to her friends. And I'd love to hear you talk about her and her work first before we talk about the book. So perhaps, Carlene, you could start and tell our listeners a little bit about your sister.
Well, thank you, Kristen. I appreciate this opportunity. It's still very difficult to talk about Ray Linda in this way. So she was the oldest of four. I am number three. But she was the big sister, and she paved the way in the family as one of the first to earn a PhD. She attended University of Connecticut, and then went on to get a master's at Yale, and then the PhD. And so she's always been that role model and advocate for education, higher education, throughout our extended family. And I describe Ray as incredibly humble. As I have learned even more about my sister these past 3 years, it is stunning how I am unfolding all of these different avenues in different ways. She touched people. And yet, when you spent time with Ray Linda, she never wore a title. You would never know she was a vice president or even a provost. It was Ray Linda. And she just quietly did the work. But what she taught all of us is that work, the work in academia, it mattered. She was not frivolous with her time. She was dedicated to her students, her roles that she played in academia, and she was very dedicated to the story of Florence Price. And I've read many papers of hers as she spoke beginning orientations at universities, and she would talk about being the first and the only. And Relinda understood what it meant to be the first and the only in academia. She understood that as part of her relationship with Florence Price. And so as she talked to first-generation students or students of color, she would use Price as an example, not so much her life, but Price as an example of how you'll do it anyways. It's okay to be the first. It's okay to be the only. Relinda understood that. And you do it anyways. And she was just this major support person for whether it be that freshman through all of us, including myself, including Guthrie Ramsey, to encourage us that the Academy mattered and that there would be a support system if we just believed in ourselves to just continue to move forward. So I owe my sister a lot in terms of how I have gotten to be where I am as a professor. She actually encouraged me in her last days to go up for professor. It's important. And I know she's had this impact on Dr. Ramsey as well. And so the totality of Ray's work, it really has reflected in how she identified with Florence Price. She wrote about that in the book. They had a similar path, personally and professionally. And that's why it's partly an extraordinary book, is because Relinda understood Florence Price.
Did you want to add to that as well, Guthrie?
Yes. I know that I am one of the people, as Carlene pointed out, who benefited from Relinda's generosity and her unique ability to share what she knows and have it make an impact. I considered her one of my first and most important mentors in musicology. I attended the University of Michigan beginning in 1989, where she was a professor until I think she was on leave my first year. And then she left, but we had met, and when I entered the field, everyone that I met who knew anything about, Black music would say, you have to meet Relinda Brown. You have to meet Relinda Brown. And when I did, we hit it off, and she took me under her wing, and she never let me go. I was, in fact, a research assistant for her when she was working on the manuscript. She gave me the task of reading the Chicago Defender from 1919, I guess, until some point in the 1950s. And, you know, of course, being a young graduate student, I'm like, is this lady crazy? This is like, you mean every single issue of every single page of the Chicago Defender? And she was, in fact, just teaching me, yes, this is called research, and this is what it takes. And, of course, she was a role, as you can read from this book, she's a role model in diligence and turning over every stone that she could in order to tell this marvelous story.
So how did you get involved with finishing this book? At what point was she at in the writing process when she died in 2017?
The book had been sitting in a box and just moved where Relinda moved. She, her life became very involved in administration. And so the final edits and putting the book together, she just didn't have the time, given how very proud of Relinda being able to achieve the role of provost. But what it took for her to take on those levels of responsibilities in administration. And so before she passed, I, of course, knew of the book. I knew where it was. She asked me to publish it. She said, it's done. And she also asked me to ask Dr. Ramsey. She trusted him. She knew that he would know what she would want to carry this forward. And so I had known of Guthrie Ramsey, certainly. Guy Ramsey was part of Raylinda's very close circle. But it was a phone call a few months after she passed where I simply called him and asked him if he would do this, be the editor, and making sure that it was going to be presented in the way that Raylinda would have hoped. And I am grateful for now this brother of mine, Guthrie Ramsey, who immediately said yes and set aside all of his projects to shepherd this. And so it was done with care and love, and it wasn't someone from the outside looking at Raylinda's work. There was a personal connection with Guthrie, and even though he didn't know it at the time when he said yes, Raylinda wanted it to be him. So there's a great gratitude from my family toward Guthrie Ramsey because it's been beautifully done.
And that's, for me, is the most fascinating part of this, because when we started talking about moving this forward to publication, Carlene actually didn't say that Raylinda asked me to do it. And I didn't learn that until everything had been done, which made it even more magical and certainly more meaningful. And so what I inherited was a big stack of manuscript, and all of the histories, the scholars will know about this, all of the histories of readers' reports and responses she had had to the book. I was surprised to find one of my readers' reports in there from the 90s, which I have completely forgotten I had done. And then in the manuscripts, you had Raylinda's notes to herself about, you know, this, that, or another thing that she was questioning or working through. And so it was just a matter of, you know, understanding at what point she had stopped the writing process, what things were and had been incorporated from the reader's reports. And then I saw my job as making sure that the book met a contemporary standard for where African-American music scholarship is, for instance, in terms of terminology and other kinds of insights that, you know, Raylinda was certainly saying, but would be put another way in this today's moment. So it was a fascinating conversation I was having with someone. And don't forget this part. I was seriously intimidated because Raylinda was my mentor, and I would never want to change anything that she had written, because I knew the type of scholar she was, is that she said what she meant and she meant what she said. So it was with much care and much, respect that I kind of got it to, because I was a series editor at the University of California Press for a decade, following my other mentor, Sam Floyd. So I knew what needed to happen. It was just a matter of making sure that all of these things came together, and that the book, as Raylinda would say, make sure that it was hanging together. That's what she would always say.
Well, I can imagine it. It must be hard to edit someone else's work when you can't talk to them anymore and sort of check, is this what you meant? Have I said, you know, have I got this right? I can see how, particularly for someone that obviously you respected so much, as you've made clear. So, but certainly, as a reader, I think you did a great job. So thank you so much for your work on this. Perhaps we could turn now to Price. And she is experiencing something of a moment. So perhaps more people know of her now than, say, would have 10 years ago. But just to make sure all our listeners know, can one of you just give us the sort of brief overview of her life, just to sort of orient people as before we talk about some more specific issues?
Well, Florence Price was born in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1887, and she died in 1953. Her claim to fame is that she was the first African-American woman to have a major work played by a professional major orchestra. As Raylinda relates this story, by the way, Raylinda is a beautiful storyteller. This is a book that will make you want to turn every page because she takes us not only from the starting point of Florence Price's life, but she traces her lineage. So back to her ancestors who were enslaved. And so what you have in this book is not only the story of an important and innovative composer, but you have the history of African Americans from the point of the emancipation all the way up to the beginnings of the civil rights movement. Florence Price was the composer of over 300 compositions, and many of them were performed in her lifetime, but not as much of it was published during her lifetime. She was a contemporary of William Grant Steele. In fact, they were both born and raised in Little Rock, Arkansas. Florence Price was also a child prodigy. She began her music lessons, and she was, because she was from an educated Black family, she excelled at everything she touched almost, and she graduated high school by age 14. And by age 16, was off from Little Rock, Arkansas to the New England Conservatory of Music, where she somehow got interested in composition and studied with composition professors there. She was a pianist. She was an organist. She was the writer of many, many children's tunes. She supported herself by teaching. And she was, at one point in her life, an accompanist for silent films. So she is an incredibly accomplished woman whose time has come. So she was really, really, you know, hot news in the 30s and the 1930s and the 1940s. And it's amazing to witness her renaissance in this contemporary moment.
You mentioned that Price came from an educated family, and one of the things that really one of the threads that Raylinda follows throughout this book is the influence of class on her life. And I think it's fair to say that she was from the what was called at the time, and historians call, the colored aristocracy. So these are educated families who were prominent in the Black community in their various towns. her father was a dentist. Her husband was a lawyer who grew up in, or first husband was a lawyer who grew up in the Black elite in Washington, D.C. And can you talk a little bit about how her background in the colored aristocracy and in this sort of Black elite influenced her life, but also where the role of color of classical music was within that social set within the Black community?
Well, certainly the music that she wrote and that she presented to the world was a combination of the oral traditions that were present in the African-American community, wed to the forms and structures of Western art music. So she was certainly from a literate tradition of music making, but she also saw her connections to people who were not privileged to have been educated, people who were mandated by the law to not be able to read. And in fact, her family, beginning with her parents and perhaps her grandparents, believed so much in education that they believed it was their mission to educate those who were less fortunate. At the same time, she had all of the aspirations that any of her white male colleagues did. She wanted her work to be published. She wanted it to get the widest hearing. She wanted major organizations to commission works from her. And she wanted to be known as an innovator and an experimenter.
So she grows up in Little Rock. She goes to the New England Conservatory of Music for her first for college, and then later she took a lot of composition classes in various places in Chicago. I mean, it's really quite noticeable how much she just continued to work on her craft long after she had already been a professional musician for many years. What was her, I guess, role and influence during her lifetime as an educator and as a composer?
I think that she saw them as one and the same. When you grow up in a Black activist environment, many, many artists believe that part of their mission through that art is to educate, is to uplift, is to, I don't want to use the word propaganda, that music was propaganda, but certainly art was a vehicle for uplift. But the thing that we need to really highlight, and it's something that Ray Linda stresses throughout the book, that as a woman of color, emphasis woman, there were certain strictures that she was bound to. For instance, when she left New England Conservatory, she just didn't head off to her artist garret to begin writing. She came home and started to teach others. And it seems as if the music took a back seat when she left to teach at Clark Atlanta University, what is now known as Clark Atlanta University. That's when she began to teach formally beyond the studio that she had set up in Little Rock. So she kept going with trying to combine her need and mission to teach with her artistic output. So I think particularly being a woman and particularly being a Black woman, those two things were really hard to separate.
Well, you bring up these challenges that she faced in her life that were, I think, rooted in her identity, that she was a Black woman. Can you talk a little bit more about the ways in which she encountered those challenges and what she was able and was not able to do to kind of get out of the systems that are, were definitely set up to keep her from being successful?
Well, number one, she was very persistent. Just imagine just how she began her career as a 16-year-old. a Black young woman going across the country to New England Conservatory to study. Who would expect her to excel in that situation? But in fact, she did. She graduated high school as valedictorian, I think. And by the time she finished New England Conservatory, she was one of the best soloists because they put her senior recital. She was placed as the last soloist. Okay, so that means that she was the ticket, as I say. Okay, so she had this determination. And even when she started raising children as women were expected to be the head, domestic person in charge, she would start writing children's songs to kind of, and many women artists have to do that. Whereas if you're a visual artist and you're a woman and you start having kids, you might stop painting and start making prints. Or you might, you do what you can do with young children in tow. So we see that pattern in her own work. So she would always find a way to do her art in whatever domestic situation she was in. When the Reconstruction period ended in the South, and it became more difficult for people, even in a thriving city like Little Rock, Arkansas, to make a living and to lead free lives, she her husband lost his job. She took on more teaching. She began to change what kinds of pieces that she was writing. She wouldn't focus on so much on the longer, bigger pieces. She was writing more, smaller pieces. So I see in and this is what Ray Linda points out in this throughout the book, is that what Florence Price did was to shift and turn at each pressure point in her life to craft her work. At one point, she writes to a friend and says, I'm so fortunate I broke my foot. Now I can sit down and finish the symphony.
Yeah, that was quite a moment. That shows how busy she was, I think, that she would welcome an injury just to give her some time to work. And it is clear that precarity and the, despite having such a great education and being from a middle-class background, precarity was very much a part of her life. Her father died in terrible debt. She had periods of great poverty in her life. Do you see, when looking at her output, do you see her crafting or maybe not crafting, but you started talking about how she switched to different kinds of music at different parts of her life. How do you see that sort of, the presence of that precarity in her life impacting her professional life?
Well, she was also a shy and retiring woman, right? She often had difficulties she knew how to hustle and grind, obviously, but she did have an issue with self-promotion. So I think more than the precarity, the economic precarity, which she was determined to always win, and oftentimes win with the help of like-minded, Black people who were on a similar mission to make their art and to keep it in the forefront. She, to answer your question directly, I don't hear any evidence, and I don't know whether Ray Linda points that out either, that there was ever a one-to-one relationship with the, say, how she was going to treat her sound organization or her the themes in her music with her economic situation. I think if she did anything is to return time and time again to, say, the great poets of the African-American tradition who are certainly addressing, who are addressing these issues in their art, to be the sort of message of what she wants to put across, right? I never got the feeling that Ray was pointing her to painting Florence Price as a somewhat musical journalist, if you will, or someone who was documenting her own personal experiences rather than the grand epic story of from slavery to freedom of African American people.
You were talking earlier about the challenges she faced as a Black woman, and there's certainly, as Ray Linda documents in the book, we might call it a pattern of exclusion throughout her life, where she, had to fight against her own shyness to get performances, to be recognized. And I was particularly struck by the time in the 30s when she was getting a lot of performances in Chicago, and her symphony was performed by the Chicago Symphony. As you said at the beginning of the interview, this is one of her big claims to fame. She was the first Black woman to have a performance of a major symphony, a work by a major orchestra. But yet, when that performance was documented, it was white writers who really took the time to talk about her music, and Black writers barely talked about her. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges she faced from within the Black community as well as from without?
Well, one of the things I learned from the going through this Chicago Defender was that the editorial policies toward Black music making changed and shift through the years. So when you had people like Nora Douglas Holt, who was both a composer, a classical musician, and a music journalist on the beat, those people would, every classical recital in any Black church at 3:30 p.m. was going to be covered, and nobody played a bad note, okay? But when it came to more popular forms like, jazz and blues, as jazz became more popular, the editorial policies toward music seemed to change, where people were paying a lot more attention to what Duke Ellington was doing, let's say, or some of the other more popular musicians were doing, instead of what Black musicians who were part of the Western art music tradition were doing. That was certainly one explanation for that.
The other thing that struck me about her time in Chicago is how much women and women's organizations, both Black and white, were really advocated for her music, performed her music, provided venues for which for her to perform. Can you talk a little bit about the role of that of women in the musical community and how that impacted her career?
Well, one of the things that I know that they all were experiencing was the sexism of the Western art music traditions, infrastructure. And Raymunda paints some very moving scenes of Florence Price, you know, needing to get some scores copied, needing to get some, you know, to prepare for a contest or a competition or a performance. And her community of women would circle around her and, you know, have it all out on the dining room table, and they're trying to help their friend. This is before, Sibelius. This is for Sibelius, where you had to write out the scores by hand of these communities of women who circled around her. I believe that these women, both Black and white, saw in Florence Price's eminent talent and in the struggles that she had to be seen and heard, they saw themselves, and they did circle the wagons and promote someone who they really believed deserved to be heard.
Yeah, that seems clear when you look at, say, someone like Marian Anderson, who sang her music so often, was a real supporter of hers. Margaret Bonds, who's a great composer in her own right, was a supporter, and as well someone, I think it sounds like Florence Price was mentored her as well. So you see her being part of this much larger network of women who were supporting each other. That's quite evident, and maybe surprising to some people as they read the book, to see just how important women were in the municipal musical life of various cities. You know, that's not just true in Chicago. It's true throughout the United States. And Florence Price really, I think, benefited from those networks that were already intact through these music clubs, for instance, that were putting on concerts and lectures and things, and often programmed Price and hired her to lecture and play.
Absolutely. And they see her raising, you know, children and trying to have a career. At some points, she was almost homeless, with two children in tow, and needed the assistance. I just think that, as I think contemporary readers will be able to identify with the Florence Price that Raylinda paints in this beautiful book.
So just turning for a moment to her music away from her life, would you call her, if you just think about her body of music, would you class her as an American nationalist composer? I mean, how would you describe her music to someone who has not heard her work before?
I would call it, I love this term that Raylinda uses, is this Afro-romantic. She certainly, at some points, hinting at like the chromaticism and atonalism that was certainly considered the avant-garde when she was doing her, you know, her strongest and most prolific work. But one of the things that I think African-American composers faced at this moment of modernism, was that, particularly during the Depression years, how are you going to get programmed and heard if you write music that is conceived of as inaccessible and for a smaller and smaller academic audience, if we could call it that? So what she was able to do is to take the full-bodiedness and the lyrical qualities of the spiritual and of Black quote unquote folk music and wed it to the forms and the language of the Romantic period in Western art music, and to come up with a unique individualized voice. So that's how I would just describe Florence Price's and kind of her idiosyncratic language. You know, she belonged to a group of musicians who were bent on doing just that, like William Brent Steele and Dawson and others.
I loved that term Afro-romantic as well, that she uses to describe Price's music. And I thought that it was really an important observation to say that you can't really analyze her music without using new terms and thinking about it in a different frame, that it's an injustice to her music to kind of treat the elements from the Black musical tradition as some kind of exoticism or something. I mean, this was embedded in the music, and I think she and that's so clear in her, the way that she analyzes the music as well.
Indeed.
So when Brown was writing this book, let me back up and say it a different way. She did, came upon, Florence Price's music, according to the book, in the late 70s when she was working in, the James Weldon Johnson collection at the, Yale University. And she, you know, she's an educated musician. She's a graduate student. And this is not that long after Price had died, but she had never heard of Price before when she happened upon a score that Price had sent to the collection. What do you think accounts for, you know, a successful musician, certainly particularly in the 30s, but continuing on in the 40s and 50s, she was still getting performances. She was getting ready to go to Europe to hear her music performed when she died. How do you account for her just absolute erasure and how people just completely forgot her after her death?
Well, once you take into account racism and sexism, you kind of left wondering why. why else? It was just very, very difficult for people, if you were not a white man, and to get into the canon. And as you say, Raylinda Brown, when she was doing this work as a graduate student, she hadn't just fallen off the turnip truck into the James Weldon Johnson collection. She was an educated musician who certainly would have heard of a Florence Price had the educational institutions let her in. And this is part of the pioneering effort of this book, is that you can see from where she was educated, how much music she wrote, how she was celebrated for about 20 years in the highest echelon of American Western art music circles. For her to drop off is because they didn't want her in there. It's the only reason that I can come up with. And this is why we're still fighting to get, to widen the canon.
Well, that's a perfect transition to the last issue that I wanted to discuss, which is what's happening with Price's music today. When Raylinda was writing this book, it seemed that a lot of her music had been lost. As you said, some of it was published in her lifetime, a fair amount, actually, but a lot of it was not. And then I think it was in 2009, a trove of her music was discovered in sort of the back room of a house that she had once lived in, and sent to the University of Arkansas I guess right before she died, Carlene, you mentioned in your afterword, she was able to inspect that collection and see that in fact there was quite a lot of new music there. And now she is being performed quite a lot. She has had several of her works were performed by major orchestras in the last couple of years. We've got new scholarship on her. I know Samantha Egge, I believe you pronounce her last name, has been working on her. Corey Hill at UNC Chapel Hill is writing a dissertation on her. So do you see this? And I should say also Shermer has acquired the catalog to her work and is publishing her work. Do you see this as a big change in classical music that Florence Price is returning to the both in performance and also Ray Lynda scholarship has inspired other people to work on her? Or, you know, what do you see this moment as for her, as a real change or something different?
I'd love to hear Carlene's idea about this.
Yes, I have an idea. Thank you. I'm glad you brought her into the discussion. I was thinking we have not heard enough from Carlene.
Well,
thank you.
But I don't get to hear enough from Dr. Ramsey anyways. You know, he's a brilliant scholar. So anytime I can listen to him, I'm happy. It has been it's been a journey to watch how Ray Lynda championed Florence Price from the moment she found those records of her work and wondered, who is this woman? And so there has been a unfortunately slow and gradual appreciation of Florence Price. And then, yes, I think that we in the academy and in the symphonic world, the classical music world, are coming to terms with inclusion. And the timing of Ray Lynda's book in this time is not lost on many of us. Florence Price was a brilliant composer. Her work has been available. And so it is now an opportunity for educators to be teaching differently, to be more inclusive. Or there's no excuse now that symphony orchestras understand if there's a Florence Price, then who else are they needing to include in their repertoire? I see this as a door opening, but it's also a reckoning right now in the field of music. In terms of what does inclusion look like? What does it take? Look how many years it took for Ray Lynda to bring Florence Price's name everywhere she went, from lectures to program notes to putting it into dictionaries of classical music. It is a time. And the question is, there's Florence Price and who else? So I love this energy. I don't believe there's a way to turn back now for educators and musicians. Florence Price to me is a door.
And I would add to that is that number one, the first reason for this uptick in Price interest is that the music is so beautiful. It is some gorgeous music. It's moving. And in the hands of these dedicated new artists who are picking this stuff up, they know just what to do with it. And they're putting so much heart and soul into the performances because they believe that it's Florence Price's moment. I'll also say another reason is that the classical establishment needs Florence Price. It's not that she needs them so much as it's time, as Dr. Brown just said, the other Dr. Brown, is that it's time to re-energize the repertoires, what composers we hear from, to expand the sonic territory of what Western art music means, and who, as as we just heard, who gets included? It's just time. And fortunately, my God, there's this small, and growing army of young scholars who are discovering Price and the performers who are discovering her. It's just because they've been looking for the life that Florence Price can provide.
Well, it's certainly true. I agree with you that it's has to be sexism or racism that kept her out of the canon, because she's clearly one of the great mid-century, 20th century composers of American music. She should be always right up there with the people that we associate with that style. So, someone like Aaron Copland. I mean, her music absolutely stands up against his and other sort of white men that we think of from that period. And I think of course that's one reason that people are playing her. But I wonder, do you worry that people will stop with that? That the New York Philharmonic can say, "Oh, we played Price," and then sort of move on? Or do you see a real commitment on the part of major institutions to go beyond Florence Price to other composers?
Well, one of the beautiful things of living during this moment, beyond the pandemic, let's not talk about that. Although Florence Price managed to keep, working through the pandemic of 1918. So we see a reckoning, to use Dr. Brown's word, in all of these, say, cultural institutions that have been surrounded by, metaphorical moats. You see it in what exhibitions museums are committing to. You see it in this strong surge of young Black women curators who are being hired by these institutions. You see it in what museums and choose to collect these days. We see that happening in an analogous way in the music world, where when people say Black Lives Matter, it's really about upending all of the conventional and traditional ways that these institutions have kept Black people, women, and so on outside and trying to get in. So I think it'll be very hard for us to turn back at this point, and we'll keep seeing more and more openness happen. And it's not as if there's not a lot of fight that will have to happen. But I think the box is open now, and I don't think we can turn back.
What do you think, Carlene?
Yeah, I agree. This past summer, it's been extraordinary in terms of the commentary from composers I am seeing. Certainly those of us in education, in academia, when we talk about curriculum, who are we including? There are young people that have an expectation now, and Price is a perfect example of why haven't we been talking about Price? And now that Relinda's book is there, and it gives educators even more information about how to explore other works. And so, as I said, there is no turning back. There is an interest among performers, composers, educators, and certainly the young people, the students. There's an expectation now that we bring more to the table than the traditional notion of what a canon is.
Well, I think on that call, it's a good time to end our discussion, but thank you so very much for joining me today. And just as a reminder, my name is Kristen Turner. This is New Books in Music, a part of the New Books Network. And I've been talking to Dr. Guthrie Ramsey and Dr. Carlene Brown about the heart of the woman, the life and music of Florence B. Price by Ray Linda Brown. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.